On Wednesday afternoon, breaking news.
Jim, one of our producers, Alberto Moya, is on the scene for us. Alberto, where are you? What are you seeing?
We're on the corner of San Bernardino Avenue and Richardson Street. There's been a massive police presence that has descended. The Sheriff's Police Department is ordering us to stay back. They do not know if there's a suspect on the location. There are multiple helicopters that are flying above me as well.
As the hours wore on into evening, we learned more.
Here's what we know at this point in time. At least 14 people are dead, and at least 17 more are injured.
But it seemed to us that even though the usual rolling coverage had taken over, the wild speculation that usually follows in the wake of a so-called active shooter situation was greatly diminished.
Is the suspect who was hit dead?
I don't have that information.
Is there another suspect who was not hit but in custody?
I don't have that information. I don't know.
It wasn't until much later that the names of the shooters were released, and we learned that they were of Pakistani descent and that they had dropped off their six-month-old baby with her grandmother before committing mass murder. But even with some of the biographical details filled in, a motive was, is still not clear.
It is possible that this was terrorist-related. But we don't know. It's also possible that this was workplace related.
President Obama offered his thoughts and prayers to the victims. He also called yet again for stricter gun controls, while many others, including every Republican presidential candidate, restricted themselves to those prayers and thoughts. One writer was not impressed. Igor Volsky, a contributing editor to the political news blog Think Progress, responded to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's thoughts and prayers tweet by tweeting that, quote, NRA dumped $922K into McConnell's reelect bid, so when it comes to preventing gun violence, all you get is this tweet. And in response to Speaker Paul Ryan's tweet came this, quote, got $2,000 from NRA during 2014 cycle to keep hashtag San Bernardino victims in his prayers, and little else. Soon the hashtag thoughts and prayers was trending and congressional hypocrisy was under the gun. Congress had long decided that firearms don't kill people, people do. But information can definitely violate our Second Amendment rights. Hours before the shooting in San Bernardino, a group of doctors petitioned Congress to lift the nearly two decades old ban that effectively prevents the CDC from researching gun violence. And the former congressman who authored the research ban, Jay Dickey, continued his campaign of apology. Todd Zwillick is Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Todd, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brooke.
So let's go back to the early 90s when this started, 1993. The New England Journal of Medicine published a CDC-funded study that found, quote, keeping a gun in the home was strongly and independently associated with an increased risk of homicide.
Right. And this is the study, you know, when you hear gun control debates amongst your friends or your relatives permeated the culture. It's more dangerous to have a gun in the home than it is to not have one. You hear that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
This is the study that showed that. That was 1993. And by 1995 and into 1996, the National Rifle Association started to lean on members of Congress to say, hey, this study that came out that was funded by the Centers for Disease Control, this is tax payer money, they're advocating for gun control. We don't want you paying for this.
So that brings us to Representative Jay Dickey of Arkansas, who attached an amendment to a 1996 omnibus appropriations bill.
He sure did, and it's short. It's only about 20 words long, and it says none of the funds made available for injury prevention and control at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention may be used to advocate or promote gun control. That's all it said. Didn't say you can't do the research. It didn't say you can't do whatever epidemiologic study you want to. And you say, well, that's not a ban. That doesn't tell people what to study. But here's the problem. And this was really crafty back in the 90s. Before they introduced this amendment, Brooke, they slashed the funding for the CDC by $2.4 million, the exact amount that had been used for this research in the Injury Prevention and Control Fund. And what message did that send? It said, you can do whatever whatever research you want. But if you report your research and that research tacitly or directly advocates for gun control, you're going to be breaking the rules.
Certainly the American Psychological Association and others have laid the blame for this amendment directly at the feet of the NRA. I don't know that the NRA would deny it. The issue seems to be that the NRA equated gun violence research with anti-gun political advocacy.
And Jay Dickey himself has talked about that, that back at this time, you have to remember how contentious the gun debate was. It's contentious now, but it was really in play. I mean, back in the 90s, they had the assault weapons ban of 1994. That had just happened. So this was a very hot and active political issue. The NRA thought that the advocacy that was coming from public health researchers, if they went into the medical journals or on the airwaves and said, my research shows that you should get rid of your gun, or my research shows that we would be safer if there were fewer guns available or if it were harder to buy a gun, yeah, they saw that as gun control, and maybe it was advocating for gun control. Nevertheless, this was the action that they leaned on members of Congress to take, and they took it.
So what kind of information don't we have, do you think, because of this ban?
Well, I think we don't know a lot about how guns hurt people in the real world. What's the interaction between having a gun in the home and substance abuse? How more likely are you to injure someone else or injure yourself with a firearm if there's alcohol in the house? How is it connected to people's income? Are people with lower incomes at higher risk? Do they have other things to watch out for? I think there are great number of things that researchers would tell you that they would like to know about how those guns, either in the home or just floating around out in the world, interact with how we act every day. That's what epidemiology is all about. And I think we lack a great deal of that information about what is it that leads to the situations where a gun can hurt a person. It's hard to imagine any other area of human harm where 33,000 people die and 85,000 are injured, by the way, where the primary government research public health agency isn't permitted to study it. It's almost an egregious omission from the perspective of science and public health.
And the same research ban was extended to the National Institutes of Health with almost the same language a few years ago. But Todd, after the shooting at that historic church in Charleston, South Carolina in July, an amendment was proposed that would have reversed the CDC research ban, but you reported that didn't go anywhere.
No, it didn't. This was a Democratic amendment in the House Appropriations Committee, and Republicans voted down an effort to reverse the Dickey Amendment. And I turned around and asked John Boehner, who was then the Speaker of the House, about it.
And he offered you this now famous reply.
Listen, the CDC is there to look at diseases that need to be dealt with to protect the public health. I'm sorry, but a gun is not a disease. And guns don't kill people. People do. And when people use weapons in a horrible way, we should condemn the actions of the individual and not blame the action on some weapon.
Well, an automobile is not a disease, and it kills the same number of people as guns every year. A bacteria is not a disease, for that matter. So I think from the epidemiologist perspective, that statement from the political sphere on Capitol Hill was really, really hard to take.
So let's talk about the man whose name is on that ban, Jay Dickey. He went through something of a conversion.
Yeah, Jay Dickey has come out. He's been talking to reporters to issue his apology. He basically said, look, this was a hot debate in the 90s. I thought that a government agency was advocating for gun control, and I did think that that was inappropriate. But I wish we hadn't gone as far. I wish they were doing the research. I wish we knew more.
Is it because he's no longer in office that he can take this position?
Almost certainly. I mean, I don't want to try to imagine or speculate what Jay Dickey would say if he were still an elected official. Who knows? But it's certainly easier for him now that he's no longer a member of Congress. Look, Brooke, this is about whether or not a public health agency can study a public health matter. And I think most people know that. But I had a conversation with a senior Republican aide here on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago and asked, are you going to undo this thing? You just have to strike 20 words and it's gone. And this Republican aide said, look, to you and me in this building, it's the Dickey Amendment. outside of this building and outside the Beltway, that's called gun control, and that's how it'll be perceived. So the answer is no.
Forever?
Well, Brooke, who knows forever? You know, frankly, this is one of the smaller issues to the gun control lobby itself. I have asked them if they want to go after this ban at the CDC, and they say they do, but they consider this low-hanging fruit. They want the assault weapons ban. They want stricter background checks, and they're afraid that if they go for reversing the ban on a couple million dollars of research at the CDC, it'll be a small moral victory, but it'll be the only crumb they get.
I just can't help questioning the logic of gun control advocates who worry about this being the solitary crumb. It seems to me that research is something you can build an argument on.
Well, I think many of them see that. I think in the world of politics, however, there's always a danger, and it's not just in the gun area. This happened in immigration, too, and I won't digress too much, but there were lots of little things that could have gotten done on immigration when the sides parted. Brooke, they didn't get done because nobody wanted the crumb. We want big immigration reform, and we're not going to chip away at all this political capital that they had. For me, this isn't really about gun control at all. I mean, I used to be a healthcare reporter and a science reporter. And from that perspective, it's really for open and unrestricted research into the things that do hurt, harm, and injure Americans, whether it's a bacteria, a virus, domestic violence, an automobile, a knife, or a firearm. And carving off one of those things because it's politically charged is something I think that many of people who value science and research and what it can do for us find it inexcusable.
Todd, thank you very much.
Brooke, it's a pleasure.
Todd Zwillick is Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from PRI and WNYC. The Los Angeles Times is writing obits for the victims of the San Bernardino shootings. Robert Adams married his high school sweetheart, Summer, and loved to attend the Renaissance Fair. Nicholas Thalassinos dropped off his wife at work. She's a second grade teacher. And on Wednesday, he also carried in the classroom snacks. Mike Raymond Wetzel could soothe a colicky infant when no one else could. As victims' families struggle to create something worthwhile out of their loss, they often find that they must learn how to manage the media to achieve their goals. The template for that kind of PR savvy was set back in 1999 after the massacre at Columbine High School, as Karen Duffin reported for us a few years ago.
My name is Craig Scott, and I am a survivor of the Columbine High School shooting. I also lost my sister, Rachel Joy Scott.
Craig was a student trapped in the library during the rampage. As he left the school, he confronted both his trauma and a country anxious to hear about it. Oprah called, Katie Couric called. He went on the Today Show 2 days after Columbine.
Two kids with trench coats on, they came into the library and they shot Isaiah.
And then you played dead, Craig.
I just ended up laying on the floor. I was praying to God.
Each time a high-profile tragedy occurs, the victims must decide, unsettled and unprepared, whether to share it.
So everything is on the fly, and that creates a lack of perspective about what are the consequences of my doing this or not doing this.
That's Steve Siegel from the Denver District Attorney's Office. He's worked with victims of Columbine, Aurora, Sandy Hook, and many other major tragedies. He says public relations professionals can spend years learning how to calculate how one interview might affect a court case, a relationship, a reputation, 5 weeks or 5 years down the road. It's like playing chess. One move affects the next. But victims don't calculate.
The vast majority of people who are willing to cooperate with the media, they are looking to try to create some sense out of a senseless act.
Craig Scott says talking to the press has been cathartic.
It was therapeutic to be able to talk and have people listen and have people be supportive.
Not everybody wants to do that, and I understand that.
That's Craig's father, Daryl Scott.
It has been not only therapeutic, but it's been a joy because it's like they're still with you as long as you share their memory.
Victims advocates like Steve Siegel say that the line between an interview feeling cathartic and feeling painful or even re-victimizing is thin. Daryl understood this.
A lot of times, media wants to see emotion, and I personally just made a decision in the early days not to perform for the camera. I don't answer a lot of questions like, how did you feel when you heard that your daughter died? I always just say, you know, like any other parent would feel.
Sometimes victims use the media simply because it's the best way to spread the word.
The parents of Adam Walsh who's been missing since yesterday noon.
You may recognize that voice.
I'm John Walsh. For 25 years, I've hunted fugitives all over the world. Tonight, I'm
his son Adam was kidnapped from a shopping mall in 1981. He begged the press to cover the story, but he says they barely did. So one week into the search, John took some PR advice from an unlikely source.
The county coroner said raise the reward.
This PR-savvy coroner told John to use the most basic tool of PR, a news hook.
It'll intrigue the media, they'll show up, and it will reinvigorate Adam's case.
Sure enough, the local papers showed up. But 2 weeks later, Adam Walsh was found dead. John still believes that press attention could have brought Adam home alive. With reason. As host of America's Most Wanted, he's used the media to help capture over 1,200 criminals. Media pressure influences the decisions of police and politicians, and that influence is enough to make an otherwise press-shy person talk to the media.
I don't know. From my point of view, I didn't think I had any choice.
Bob Swartz is the father of internet activist Aaron Swartz. In 2011, the federal government charged Aaron with illegally downloading files over the MIT network. Amidst a very aggressive prosecution, Aaron committed suicide, and his death sparked an international outcry.
He was a computer prodigy, an online activist.
He was an idealist who believed we had to live up to something better.
Unlike the Scots, Bob Swartz doesn't like talking to the press.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, emotionally, it's incredibly hard. And I try to erect some degree of emotional distance, but it's very difficult. I mean, what happened was just so shattering that one has a responsibility to make sure that these kinds of things don't happen again.
Bob's goals are ambitious: to make all academic literature free, to modify federal computing laws, and to make structural changes at MIT. So Bob did look for PR help, and he found a professional willing to advise him pro bono.
Well, I think he helped make sense, you know, begin to make sense out of what was going on. You know, try to understand how to approach this. I mean, it was a completely new experience, and I didn't have a clue.
Bob is confronting institutions that have PR experience and deep pockets. But he has the advantages all victims and their families have: a public profile, deep, tragically earned credibility, and an emotional story that provokes interest in arcane-sounding issues. So he can use the media to help level the playing field. But moving from human interest to influence means learning how to attach a personal story to big issues and concrete solutions. In PR speak, this means learning how to bridge. John Walsh.
When I got involved in trying to force the FBI and the Justice Department to stop opposing the missing children's bill, I knew that I would only have a short amount of time on air, and I had to be succinct. I had to be articulate. I had to have a call to action. I better know what I was talking about. And I had to have something to say other than crying and pleading for Adam.
Walsh got his bill passed, and Bob Swartz, advocating after his son's suicide, helped prompt Congress to introduce a bill called Aaron's Law, and MIT to conduct an internal review of its role in Aaron's case. Meanwhile, the Scots have also become advocates for a larger cause through an anti-bullying program they founded called Rachel's Challenge, based on the life and writings of Rachel Scott, Craig's sister who died at Columbine. They say it's the largest school assembly program in the country, and that it's prevented at least 7 school shootings and 500 suicides. But the passion that gives these particular advocates their power also saps their strength. This isn't a product pitch. It's their lives, focused on the worst moment of their lives. John Walsh says,
I say it to every victim. You really don't have an obligation to carry forward. If you can't carry forward financially, if you can't carry forward emotionally, if you can't carry forward because it's destroying your family relationships, then don't do it.
Steve Siegel from the Denver District Attorney's Office says to remember, you can say no to the press. And if you say yes, you can set the parameters. He also says to be realistic about what you can actually get from talking to the media.
You know, you hear the word closure. Telling my story will bring me closure. It just really does not, in my experience, provide that. And what the real search is for, incorporating this horrible experience into your current circumstances.
You know, look, my son's dead, and everything else is meaningless as compared to that, but you want to make sure that maybe some small amount of good can come out of such a immense tragedy.
People that say, Craig, how do you continue to talk about it and do the media? You know, it's like, you don't get it. Just join me for one trip and see what I see, and then tell me how could I not do it.
Living in the spotlight is a challenging new reality for victims and their families. As Bob Swartz said, his son is dead. Everything after that is meaningless. But if they can learn how to play the media while factoring in their own limits and tolerance for the game, they may be able to find some meaning, even in the meaningless. For On the Media, I'm Karen Duffin.
I'm Brooke Gladstone. This has been an OTM Podcast Extra.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.